Good evening, everybody. Can I start the proceedings of this evening? Welcome, everybody, to the Arcadia seminar tonight. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Sue Mera. I'm the acting deputy librarian at the University Library. And it's my pleasure to chair this evening's seminar. I'm told we're following the Oxford format. That might mean something to some people, not necessarily much to me. But what we are intending to do is, you know, we'll have the main talk, and then there'll be a response from Professor John Norton, who's the academic advisor for the Arcadia project, and then we throw open the floor for general discussions. So it's my pleasure to introduce Hugh Jones, who is a systems librarian at the Libraries at Cambridge team and will be known to many of you in the room. He's been an Arcadia fellow during the Easter term.
Easter term this year.
Working on reading lists, and he'll present us with his findings. So this evening's seminar is based very much on the report that he's produced for the Arcadia Fellowship, and which is available on the Arcadia website for you to download if you want to follow it up. So over to you.
Thank you. For some time there's been a feeling of unease in Cambridge about the whole business of reading lists. A sense that the way in which they're handled is problematic. My own involvement with reading lists began last year when I attended a committee of librarians from across the university, coincidentally chaired by Sue, where it quickly became apparent that reading lists were a major area of concern. Students talk about lack of clarity and difficulty accessing resources. Academics talk about a heavy time burden and problems keeping lists up to date. Librarians are concerned about the availability and the currency of lists. And yet, reading lists work. Resources on reading lists continue to be recommended by academics, provided by libraries, and used by students. So there's clearly something going on here, but it's not entirely clear what that something is. This evening I'm going to try to elucidate what's going on with reading lists and what we might do to address this uneasy feeling. And I'll focus on four broad areas. Why do we care about reading lists? Why are they important to us? Why are we concerned about the way that reading lists are handled? Is there a problem with them? And if so, what is it? That's an easy one. Assuming there is a problem, what might a solution involve? I don't promise to answer. What are the benefits, and would there be any broader ramifications? And what are we doing now to achieve a solution? And what might we need to do in the future? I'll be arguing that advances in technology, sometimes referred to as the digital transformation of higher education, offer whole new ways of working in teaching and learning. There are opportunities now which simply didn't exist in the past. And that the real nature of the problem with reading lists isn't some dreadful flaw in the existing system, but the feeling that we're not taking advantage of these opportunities. And also that while the driver of change might be technological advance, the actual changes we need to make are mainly organisational, particularly to do with engaging users and the way institutions and groups work together. And that the combination of these technical and organisational factors mean that we're in a unique position to do something exciting and important with reading lists. It's no accident that reading lists are on the agenda for many universities at the moment. Now is the time to do something about them. And finally, I'll be arguing that we're already well on the way to tackling the problem of reading lists, which might come as a surprise to some of you. And that a major factor in this progress has been work associated with the Arcadia programme. So that's quite a lot to get through. I'm going to talk for about 35 minutes, 40 minutes maybe, after which John will respond, as Sue said, and finally there'll be a discussion which Sue has kindly agreed to chair. So to get started, let's have a look at why reading lists are important. Why should anyone care about reading lists and the way that they are handled? And I assume that as you're here, you already care a little bit about reading lists, so I'm not going to dwell too long on this point. But I think it's worth going over the range of different groups in the university that have an interest in reading lists before we go on to look at why reading lists have become more important now. So, in a very simple sense, reading lists act as a bridge between two of the university's most valuable assets, academic expertise and resource provision. And they occupy a unique position in teaching and learning as an area where the interests of students, academics and librarians interact. They also act as a focus for communication between these groups. So if you see a student or academic talking to a librarian, the chances are, not exclusively of course, that somewhere along the line a reading list will be at the bottom of it. And as anyone who works in the library will know, when you see an undergraduate wandering in with a look of desperation on their face, they've either got a reading list in their hand or they need the loo. Need to find where the loo's on there. It's not just... For students, reading lists are central to learning. In the recent IRIS report, which was a survey of students' information skills, which was also the product of an Arcadia Fellowship by Liz Edwards-Waller, reading lists were identified as the dominant source of information about books, journals, and other course materials. This isn't going to come as any great surprise to any of you. Almost all respondents using lists to find resources. They're really central to undergraduate life. And they're also very important to academics as teaching tools and to librarians as resources for collection development. But these are really in support of the main point that reading lists and the way they're handled are fundamental to the student's experience. And this is something I'm going to come back to again and again, I think, in the talk, and it's something which struck me when I was working on reading lists, that we talk about interest groups in the university, about the interests of librarians and about the interests of students. But when you really get into the kind of nitty-gritty of something like teaching and learning, you realise that really everyone's trying to do the same thing, which is to do teaching and learning better. So it's useful in a sense to talk about these different interest groups, but actually it's more of a kind of community of interest. And that's got particular relevance for reading lists. So, as teaching and learning is one of the key institutional aims of the university, we are right to feel uneasy if we have concerns about how lists are created, distributed and used. And it's not a trivial matter. So, what's wrong with the way reading lists are currently handled? Probably the best place to start is to take a look at extracts from a few lists. I'm not sure if you'll be able to read them from that distance. And see what they're trying to do and whether they're doing it effectively. I should make it clear that these are completely random. I didn't try to target any institutions or individuals. My choice of reading lists. So we can look at each of these lists and see what's going on. We can imagine a student reading the list, understanding it, and going about finding and using the resources on it. This is quite a funny one. It says, indeed, there aren't really any good books at the appropriate level, which yes, I didn't notice until now. This one is fairly well written. I hope that, what's his name? T.M. Duncan never gets his hand on this slide. Maybe we should do that. Some of them support sophisticated functionality for linking through to resources. The lists are comprehensible and useful. And in modern parlance, they seem to be fit for purpose. They do the job. I thought on the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species in 2009, Darwin's year, it would be remiss not to include a slide on Darwin. So here's Darwin's reading list. But it's interesting to think that an undergraduate today could probably take that list, walk into the university library and find most of the things on it and use them. It actually illustrates something quite important about the way the fundamental function of reading lists has not changed. Yet. So what's the problem? Right, perhaps we'll get a little further by looking at the purpose of lists. Reading lists are a means of directing use of resources and also of ensuring that the need for resources is fulfilled. So, and the way they do this is through recommendation. So that we can say that while the form is a list of resources, that's what a student has, the function being performed is one of recommendation. To students, that they use particular resources, and to libraries, that they provide particular resources. So it's kind of the same thing to two groups. Incidentally, I was having a conversation with Tony the other day, and he suggested it might be more useful to think of lists as recommendation lists than reading lists, considering that a lot of the things which now appear on them and will appear on them in the future are not things which you read, such as video, audio, podcasts, etc., etc. And the end point of all this is something we might call fulfillment, when a student metaphorically or otherwise has the recommended resource in their hands and is able to use it. And the mechanism by which all this happens is citation, which is something we'll come back to later on. Our citations being items on lists. So if the primary function of reading lists is recommendation, are reading lists performing this function less well than they used to? I would argue that they're not, but they're performing it less well than they could, which is quite a big difference. And it means that something must have changed. And what is the nature of this change? I'm afraid it's the usual culprit, which is technology. The most obvious aspect is the new possibilities offered by rapid advances in technology. Now, we're all aware of the impact of networked information on all areas of our lives, from ordering books on Amazon to paying a phone bill. Now, are we moving fast enough to ensure that the experience we offer to students is commensurate with our own expectations, let alone theirs? Perhaps not. And perhaps the reason we feel uneasy about reading lists isn't that the current system is failing, but that we fear we're missing the opportunity to do things better. So what are these things which could be done better? What are the benefits we feel we're missing out on? I think they fall into two broad groups. There are immediate benefits, which are essentially ways of doing things lists already do better. So it's not a change of function, it's just taking those functions and doing them better. And then there are wider ramifications, which is about doing new things around teaching and learning and recommendation. So starting off with the things that lists already do, trying to improve the way that they do. So improvement to the undergraduate user experience. We've already seen that lists are important to undergraduates. What difference would the standard system for reading lists make to their lives? The first thing that you notice when you're trying to find reading lists, and this was came home to me when I was trying to find the examples, is that it isn't a particularly easy business to go about finding them. And I was amused to find out that the Darwin list was the easiest to find. I typed in Cambridge reading lists into Google and it was on page one. There it was, that being 150 years old. But they're not easy to find. So some are on departmental websites, some are in councils. Some are open access to everyone, others aren't. Some are on personal websites, some are just written down on bits of paper. There's no easy way of improving, no standard way of improving. So the primary advantage of a standard system for reading lists would be a consistent means of discovery, which in essence means providing a standard interface which allows you to search or browse for reading lists at the university. This process becomes even more powerful if you build interfaces which know who you are, recognise a student's login, what course they're on, and provide you with relevant list information. So search all lists, browse lists, but here are your lists. The second important factor for undergraduates is clarity. As things stand, students are not only faced with a range of different ways of discovering lists, but with a range of list functionality. And as someone said to me recently, no one comes to Cambridge for the variety of its reading list systems. It's not a big sell. Consistent functionality linked with consistent tools for discovery would simplify an area where complexity is a hindrance rather than an advantage. I think there are areas where complexity and diversity are an advantage, but reading lists really isn't one of them. And the third, and perhaps most important factor, is shortening the journey from recommendation to fulfillment, which is about list usability. And the essential functionality here is to do with citations, I was talking about, and it's to do with the automatic generation of links from citations to resources. Now, many online reading lists, including probably some that have been worked on by people in this room, already link through to resources. But these links tend to be manually created, hard-coded links from one citation to one resource. They just go one link. Now, a standard system would be able to do something quite important, which would be to provide a mechanism for linking through to all relevant resources in a standard way, all relevant resources matching that citation. Taking it further, with the idea of relevance to the student, all resources relevant to that student. Which would not only make the journey from recommendation to fulfillment much shorter, it would also better illustrate the range of resources on offer. Which is where electronic resources come in. Promotion. There are two factors here. The first is that libraries are understandably keen to see a return in use on the huge investment that's been made in electronic resources over recent years. And the second is that, as the IRIS report pointed out, there is a surprisingly low awareness of electronic resources amongst undergraduates, which surprised me. And it probably means that if the list doesn't mention an electronic resource, then they don't look for an electronic resource. Which means if either the person creating this is unaware there's an electronic resource, or if the list is being made, was created before the electronic resource became available, it just disappears. And there's no doubt that a standard system for linking from citations to the whole range of available resources would increase the exposure and use of electronic resources, which, again, this community of interest, it's good for libraries and it's good for students and it's good for academics. The present fragmented way of creating and distributing reading lists is very time and labour intensive, as I'm sure many of you know. Often a number of people are involved in list creations, academics, administrative staff and librarians. There's no clear, efficient method for the distribution of list information. And the lack of a consistent link between list data and library data means that librarians spend an awfully long time every year checking list content against their holdings. Time which could be much better spent doing something else. A standard system would mean the production of easy-to-use interfaces which would allow one person, i.e. in most cases an academic, to create and maintain lists themselves. Successful reading list implementations usually rely on this engagement of academics in the process of list creation. List distribution would be handled automatically to provide everyone with relevant information. And the whole laborious process of gathering reading lists, sending them out and marking them up against library holdings would be a thing of the past. So instead of getting a reading list through the post, if it arrives at all, you would get an email saying, these things have been added, which you don't hold yet, have been added to a reading list which you're interested in. Or these things which you do hold have been removed from a reading list that you're interested in. So that would be the mechanism which would save them the news. And of course, the distribution of relevant information to students would also be similar lines. And the net result of that would be that library collections would be more focused on resources that students actually need, and students would have a better chance of getting their hands on material recommended by academics. So these are all functions which lists perform already, but they could perform better. On their own, are these benefits enough to make us move towards the adoption of a standard system? Perhaps, but a standard system also has the potential to extend the range of functionality surrounding reading lists and to make things possible in teaching and learning which are simply not possible now. So a system for reading lists would not only be an achievement in itself, it would also be a stepping stone to new ways of thinking about the essential processes of teaching and learning. So some of the broader long-term benefits of a project to tackle reading lists could be... the extension of a standard system for discovery and use of reading list documents to other learning objects, such as exam papers, syllabi, handouts, podcasts, etc. So essentially bringing the whole complex world which undergraduates encounter when they arrive in Cambridge together in an integrated and joined up way. What can apply to reading lists can apply to other learning objects. closer engagement and communication between all of the bodies involved in teaching and learning, something I'll come on to later. Reading lists do act as a focus of communication at the moment. The adoption of a standard reading list system can only help this communication. The interaction of data sets to extend the services and functionality we can offer to the users of our systems. Offering new services based on the solid foundation of a consistent approach to our data sets and the links between them. Essentially, what I'm saying is that we think of library data, of list data, data held by CARAT and CAMSIS data, the student registry. Us users don't see those divisions. To them, it's just all the stuff of their life. So joining the data together allows us to build systems which act in the way that they expect. And then the flip side of that coin, use of the links between these data sets to extend our understanding of how our own institutions work and interact. The current fragmented system is simply not understandable because nothing joins up. Once this data can talk to library data, it's data from the student registry, data in CAM tools, the questions you can ask are endless. So, for instance, my Christmas stocking filler bestseller for next year is the top 100 books borrowed by students who got firsts in Cambridge. Which you could pull that out. By this Christmas, you'll be able to pull it out. Or, conversely, the top 100 books used by students who fail. Books to avoid, or texts for success, as I call them. I'm actually quite serious about that. But more sensibly, very, very soon we'll be able to... I have to be brief because of time. Very, very soon we'll be able to get borrowing figures based not on library use but on course, where we are to track the borrowing of people on a course across the university, no matter in what library, and produce these figures for librarians and for students, which is a pretty interesting thing to be able to do. And that's just one example of a new functionality, something which we haven't been able to do before, but we will be able to do in the near future, and that's to do with one link between two sets of data. So using consistent functionality to allow those involved directly in teaching and learning to do new things with tools and data, tapping into the ideas and expertise of Cambridge students and academics. But the general point that being that in 10 years' time people will be teaching and learning in new ways we can't even imagine now. And we need to move towards providing the tools to enable them to do this. So opening up our systems to the users of our systems. So all of this is really about contributing to an integrated and joined up range of services based around teaching and learning. Now at the start I talked about now being the time to do something about reading lists. Now why is this? Any change has potential benefits and potential costs. We've looked at the technological advance and how the benefits that a standard reading list system would bring have grown. I apologise for that terrible animation. It seemed like a good idea. Now it's time to look at the potential costs, which is what would need to be done to put a standard reading list system in place. And I would argue that we're at a tipping point with reading lists, where the potential benefits of investing in the broadest sense in the standard system is starting to outweigh the potential cost. So we've looked at some of the real immediate benefits of a standard system for reading lists and also some of the potential benefits for the future. But the peculiar thing about this particular case is that one of the long-term benefits of a system actually might be associated with the cost, i.e. the pain actually has a benefit. And that the very process of setting up a standard reading list system would have far-reaching ramifications beyond the system itself. Now, in order to explain this rather peculiar viewpoint, I'm going to go through some of the things we would need to do to achieve a standard reading list system. Now, having said that I wasn't going to talk about technology or anything technological, I'm just going to touch on it, but there's nothing further on this slide. This is it. This says technology question. So it will be brief. So I've already said that the difficult issues in providing a reading list system aren't technical. But it might be worth just touching on what the technical issues are and to see if they do present any obstacles. So one of the great things about digital networks is that they facilitate the joining up of disparate sets of data. In this case, the data on reading lists, all those citations, with the resources provided by libraries and others, books, journals and electronic resources, and with students' information, i.e. that relevance of who is looking for this. And we've seen it in a paper-based system or an online system which is still, in a sense, operating like a paper-based system, putting PDFs up, which people then use as if they're on paper. In a paper-based system, you don't need a particularly high level of standardisation to achieve your goal, the goal being comprehensibility. In order for people to understand lists written on paper, you don't need to have a lot of standardisation. You basically just need to use the English language. And I think, you know, the cover, the first slide illustrates that. If you write, read P6 to 7 of Jones on Roman history, then people get it. But to take advantage of the opportunities offered by new technologies, you need to make lists comprehensible to computers, which either means teaching a computer to think like your average undergraduate, in some ways a laudable aim. Sorry, I can't do anything. Or standardising reading lists so they become comprehensible to computers, which in practice means standardising the way lists are held, where they are and what they're called, so that computers can find them, and the way lists are expressed, how you do all the citations, how you format them, so computers can read them. And if that all sounds pretty simple, that's because it is. There are no real technical barriers to a reading list system, and indeed there are existing systems, some locally written, some commercial, which would already meet many of our needs. So technology isn't the problem. And if technology isn't the problem, what is? Now, I'd argue that the real issues are to do with coordination of services in the university, across the university. Many groups across the university have a stake in reading lists, and this is what makes them very important, but it's also what makes them very difficult to deal with. It's difficult to do anything about them because so many people have got a vested interest. So the real question is how the actions and interests of the various groups involved with reading lists might come together. Because unless all of the groups involved with reading lists are engaged, a project for a standard system will fail. Now, in the past, when the potential benefits of a standard system for reading lists were not very significant, before this rapid advance in technology, it wasn't a very important question. However, as we have seen, changes in technology have hugely enhanced the potential benefits of standard systems, and so enhanced the potential benefits of cooperation. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this is the very time that cooperation and collaboration has come onto institutional agendas in a way that we've never seen before. For instance, it's the General Board of Teaching and Learning. So technological change offers huge benefits, particularly in the current climate when we're all being asked to do more with less. And in order to take advantage of these benefits, institutions and groups need to work together. And reading lists are an ideal place to start. It's not sure what's going on. I recently had a conversation, probably again with Tony, about just collaborative projects. And the problem they have with people collaborating on things which are at the margin of their business. Maybe it was with Ed. Two institutions get together and they say, let's collaborate on something. And they have a discussion about it and they say, we've got to start small. Let's do something that's really marginal to both of us and we'll collaborate on that. And the project runs, it's successful. At the end of it, they both walk away. What you need to do to cement partnerships is to collaborate on something which is vital to all of you, because then you can't walk away from it. Even if it turns really hard. No, that's not.
I didn't mean to say that.
No, it wouldn't. Obviously, it wouldn't turn really hard. Erase that last. In Cambridge, reading lists, which are so important to so many groups, are a good example of this kind of central project. A project which could cement long-term working partnerships between bodies involved in teaching and learning support, which is a good thing. So who are these bodies? As far as reading lists goes, there are four key players. Libraries, which provide resources on lists, and also, especially as time goes by and since the Teaching and Learning Review, library services seem to have a remit for providing systems which directly support teaching and learning, getting involved in teaching and learning in a more direct way. Carrots, You provide CamTools, which is the university's virtual learning environment, which would seem to be the natural place to host any central system. Management and Information Services Division, who hold the student data. They run CamSys, the student registry, and that personalised student course information would be vital to providing that relevance I've been talking about, providing relevant information to users. So this is the data that's relevant to you because you're on this course. And academics, who are obviously the key players. They create, maintain and distribute lists, and their involvement would be the key to the success of any system. So reading this could provide a blueprint for collaborative working between these groups and institutions. And it's this close cooperation between groups involved in teaching and learning which will allow us not only to provide better services now, but to meet the challenges of the future. So if we think a standard reading list system is a worthwhile endeavour, if we do think that, where are we currently with reading lists? And where might we go in the future? In this section, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Arcadia program itself. For those of you not familiar with it, it's a three-year project with REMIT to explore the role of academic libraries in a digital age and to create new programs and services, particularly for undergraduates. So reading lists already are fitting quite well into that. The program is now in its second year, and if we take a look at the projects which have been completed so far, which I intend to, and projects which have been made possible by it, we can get the sense that there is a narrative, a building of idea upon idea, and that the creation of a standard system for reading lists might be something which might fit very well into this narrative of events. So to begin at the beginning, the first Arcadia project was undertaken and maintained by Lee Kwazu, Science at Cambridge, which was an ambitious and successful attempt to aggregate relevant material for students on science courses. From news to publications to library information to relevant resources, useful links, and even selected material from reading lists. So at the very outset, the program was dealing with ideas of relevance, with bringing information together for students in an easily accessible and comprehensible way, aggregating relevant information. And the next two projects picked up on some of these ideas and took them forward. The IRIS report on undergraduate information skills by Liz Edwards-Waller, which I've already referred to, set out to discover what services and skills were most relevant to students. What were the priorities and where were the gaps? Now, I've already mentioned that reading lists came through as enormously important to students, and that Liz's findings were very influential in my own selection of a topic. And this kind of direct engagement with users is invaluable in providing services which respond to their needs. In the same term, Karen Mills of the Open University produced a report on the mobile library. I'm sure I wasn't alone in thinking that was the van travelling around the country lane. But it was actually... Maybe I was alone in that. Sorry. I always was embarrassing. But the idea of reaching out to students to provide information in places and ways convenient to them. Again, picking up and engaging users and meeting their needs wherever they are looking for information. And then my fellow, we never got tired of that joke, for the summer term was Stephanie Hunsberger of Manchester University, whose project on teaching and learning opportunities in Second Life picked up on this theme of extending the services we provide out of traditional library spaces and into the information we know users inhabit, as well as crucially highlighting the importance of engaging with others directly involved in teaching and learning. So when I embarked on my own project, I was already operating in the environment of this community of ideas. I was able to draw on the work and support of others to follow the significant threads of engaging with students and academics, aggregating relevant information, identifying and meeting needs and expectations, and taking library services outside the library to where the users are. So what I suppose I'm saying is that reading this seemed to be the next natural progression in this kind of narrative of ideas. So where does this leave us with reading lists now? Well, if there isn't a saying, once an Arcadia fellow, always an Arcadia fellow, there should be. It's a bit like the friendly version of the Matthew. The priorities, skills and partnerships formed in the programme have already borne fruit in a close working partnership with Carrot, and between Carrot and the Library Service, which has already resulted in the development of a library interface or widget, which brings together relevant library information for users in CamTools, Facebook and iGoogle. These will be properly launched in the near future. Now, I was surprised to see the other day, with no publicity, the Facebook version has already got 107 users and 16 fans. Just goes to show that the way you think about launching services, I've never had fans before. I wonder if I should write some. But the way we think about launching services, I've always thought about launching things from the top down, advertising. Put something out there, sometimes it just grows, and that's an interesting model. I mean, the reason I bring this up isn't just to show off, it's that this is a direct prototype for a reading list system. Literally, if you put the little box there called lists, you've got a login, the system knows who you are, if it knows where to find the list, can match it with your course code, then it's done. Essentially, when I said that we're a long way towards it, that this is what I mean. Not that I've been secretly beavering away in a bunker writing my reading list, but other things which have naturally grown out of it have nearly taken us there. And we're also forming links with MISD, who run CAMSIS, the student registry, and we're hoping to have instant access to the student course codes, which will make the retrieval of really useful information for undergraduates in place by Christmas. So again, that's very close. And this link, again, it's useful in its own terms, but it's vital for the construction of a reading system. And meanwhile, things roll on. And anyone who's following the immense block output of current Arcadia fellow Tony Burst will realise that we're not short of new ideas. and kind of new ways of putting things together. It's a really, this very exciting time things are happening. So to recap, what's already in place? Remit for collaborative working. The expectation of joined up services for users. The important working partnership between library services, Carrot, and the Management and Information Services Division. And the technical framework for the building the standard system and the interfaces to support it. So in a sense, that's already all there. But there are still important questions to be answered. And this is where I'm into leading things. So what still needs to be done? Project ownership. Do we need project ownership? If so, who's going to provide that project ownership? Project delivery. Need people to do the work? Engaging the key users, particularly engaging academics. It's vital, and it's the most difficult thing. And any suggestions at all on how to do it would be very, very well. But finally, I think that the most important point is you know, a standard reading list system will happen when there's enough need for it to happen. And I think this is really the kind of the argument at the moment. Are the drivers that would make a standard list system happen enough to turn the idea into a reality? Because essentially most of the other things. So, thank you very much for listening, and I'll hand over to John.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Those of you who don't know, you will now realise why it was such fun having him as an Arcadia Fellow. He said that he hadn't been skunking in a bunker incubating this stuff. That's not true. Because the Arcadia Project has an office in the University Library. It's
true.
Five floors down, just above the water table. And for a long time I thought I couldn't get to it because I don't have the kind of ring of jailer's keys that people who work in the University Library have, but I discovered there is a secret route to it. But there is a bunker, it's an Arcadia bunker in the University Library, and in it you will find Arcadia Fellows skulking and looking at things like this. I just want to make a couple of points. One of them is, when I looked at the title for your talk, with the word problem, it rang a bell. One of the books that's had the most influence on me in the course of my academic life is a book by Donald Schoen called The Reflective Practitioner, I think some of you may know. And it's a very, well, I found a very important and insightful book because it knocks on the head the delusion that what professionals are problem solvers. So that the traditional view of medics or of lawyers or of accountants or whatever is that professionals are people who solve problems. And Donald Sholin's perspective was radically different from that. He said, professionals actually are people who create problems. And that sounds glib, but it isn't. What he meant was that a professional is... A problem is essentially a trivial thing. A problem is a discrepancy between where you are and where you want to be. If you're in that happy situation that you know where you are and you know where you want to be and people are agreed on it, then all you have to do is figure out a way of getting from A to B. And that's actually relatively straightforward. The difficulty we have is that most of the things that matter to us in life are not problems in that sense. Because, in general, there's no general agreement about where we are at the moment. And there's usually very little agreement about where we want to be. And in those circumstances, whatever you've got, it isn't a problem. It's something like a mess. And Sholin's point was that what professionals do is they take those badly formulated difficulties that people have in organisations and in life, and they do work on them in order to convert them into problems that can then be solved. So you take something that's really complicated and you do some work on it to convert it into something that you can work on. And from the time that Hugh started on his project, my feeling was that that's what he was really doing. And I remain of that view, and I think his presentation confirms that. There is a problem situation. There is a mess surrounding reading lists in the university, in every university, I think. And in order to make headway on it, we have to do something with that. And what I saw Hugh's project as being, and his presentation tonight as doing, was of helping to do what Donald Sholin would do on it, which is to do some work on it, to convert it to something that you can look at and do something about. So I'm really grateful to him for that, and I appreciate it very much. A few other points before I stop. I liked the way in which you delineated the use of technology under two general headings. The first thing is to do what we already do better, and secondly, to do things that up to now we couldn't conceive of doing. And just to take two examples in that area, doing things that we existing things that could be better. One of the things that's really baffling to, must be baffling now to new generations of undergraduates, is why the systems of collaborative filtering that, for example, they're regularly exposed to when they use Amazon or other online services, where if you buy something from Amazon, you get a nice helpful suggestion saying people who bought this also found this helpful or whatever. Why none of this appears to apply in the university world? But if you get a reading list or if you look up something on news and whatever, but the system doesn't seem to be interested in telling you that actually there's other stuff that people find useful and the rest of it. And I think that's an example where we could use technology to do something the student's already accustomed to, but except outside the university environment. The second thing was doing things that at the moment nobody can do. And I thought the example you used, Hugh, of the way in which there is no technical reason why now a student couldn't log into CamTools or whatever and find not only their reading lists, not only links to them and the rest of it, but also, for example, their exam papers. All that kind of stuff. We know all of that's already doable. And of course, that brings me back to the problem of Donald Sholin's distinction between a problem and a mess, which is that it's clear the technical problems in relation to this are relatively trivial. And yet, it's also clear, and I think everybody in this room probably feels it, that it would be a pretty steep challenge to get from where we are to where we could be if we use technology. And then you have to ask the question, what are the central bits to it, and that's what you came out at the end. I think there are a lot of important stakeholders in this. This is a very complex university. making anything happen in it was difficult. Mm-hmm. And towards the end of Hugh's project, we discussed possible ways of moving forward. And there are no textbook solutions to this. One idea that we discussed, and that I'm still keen to recommend, is that in institutions like this, what sometimes works best is to identify people who are kind of, these would be academics in the main, who would be recognized within the institution as having high prestige, either because they're thought leaders or because they are very prominent or because they are seen by their peers to be progressive, to identify a number of these academics within the university who might buy into a standard reading list system and just let it roll after that. But what I'm really trying to say is that the problem of persuading this complicated network of very different and conflicting stakeholders is one that we need to focus on as something that we might be able to solve. But having said that, I'd like to go back and throw it. Thank you.
Thank you, John. So, floor is open for questions, comments, observations. Anybody? Hugh.
I'd like to sort of pick up what John was saying, really, because it sort of goes back to one of the things I felt was a part of this, that, you know, we've been trying, the university collectively has been trying for the past 30 or so years, somebody else might get a better sense of the precise dates, to organise reading lists, you know, way back in the paper era. This is what academics were expected to deliver and constantly failed. I'm sorry to be rude to the academics in the audience, but you are outnumbered by librarians. And I was a bit worried to see that the academics were the fourth on the list of the stakeholders on that slide, and they're halfway down the list of what needs to be done here. And I go with John, I think
that's the big issue.
Absolutely crucial organisational thing, and in the absence of a university which is prepared to ordain things from the top down and say, you must do this, then we go back to what Lynn Conway was saying yesterday lunchtime, for example. There has to be something in it for the academics and who they perceive to be their immediate users. And what I don't see at the moment is any clear sense of, I am running a course, God forbid, but anyway, here I have a course on 17th century music, which I know. Here is my reading list, here are my 22 students. I can distribute this reading list to them in whatever form I need. I don't need to spend any time and effort doing this work. They don't need. They have to invest a bit of time and effort in turning it into something usable, just by taking time to use points. But what's in it for me, and what's in it, is there sufficient in it for me to go with something more centralised, more controlled, more stuff I might have to learn other than Word 2000, whatever, and so on and so forth. And that's the bit that worries me. I quite agree that technology is relatively trivial.
I think that what you would have to do is to get an interface which was easier than what's being done now, preferably easier, and which offered a key little bit of functionality to get people started, which made it better for people. So I actually, in my conversations with academics, I have spoken to a few academics, particularly at the English faculty, and they say, when I say, oh, dragging and dropping citations into reading lists, their eyes light up, and they're like, what? Okay, right. Oh, so yeah, maybe I am interested. So something as trivial as that. If you find out how they're doing it now and give them something which causes them no pain, then I think you're in with a chance. I think you're still. You're still facing a bit of an uphill struggle because you're the very act of getting them to change might be difficult. But I think this comes back to what John said. What you need to do is identify people who are essentially on your side, and people who will lead other people.
Leslie,
I think one of the difficulties that we face here is really the use and the uptake of capitals as the virtual learning environment. In other academic institutions, undergraduate, that's their first port of call, is whatever the VLE that is provided. And I was wondering if you've spoken to Carrot or you had any idea about the uptake of CAM tools across the university for undergraduates. I mean, if you're going to develop something that's going to be the portal, are the undergraduates going to go there for anything other than just to access the reading list?
If But what Karen say is that if there's vital information or a vital service for them in cantals, then they go. If not, not. So certain courses use cantals a lot, and all of their students use it. And others don't, and it's as if it's invisible. Now, I think what Carrot's big interest in these kind of more general services are very, very interested in this the library widget, because it's not a course-specific thing. It's something that it's a service which everyone can come into cantals and use. And I think that this is that the reading list, in a sense, is between. In one sense, it's a central service. In another sense, at least initially, it will depend on which course you're doing or whether the academics on the course are using this particular service. But that's in a sense you make cantals the virtual learning environment of the university by embedding essential services in. And that's in a way. And it's difficult.
Can I add an extra cherry onto this particular cake? That in Deep South, there is a second virtual learning environment for medical school that isn't campus, or isn't Cantals, because Cantals doesn't do the job for the graduate medical students.
And I think the experience again, with the library widget shows that you can have different versions to the same information, but that's
Michelle.
As not a librarian, not an academic, I'm
an outsider.
And I'm curious to know why you can't engage the student to put the information like Wikipedia, where people can just start adding things. So if you're a student on a course and you've got your reading list on paper, you know, you've said yourself that people find you on Facebook, they follow students. Could well be the tool that gets these reading lists there that force the academics to think, hang on, my students are putting this down, I better take ownership of this.
It's very, very interesting. You know, Tony, we were talking about this the other day, about academics, in a sense, have got, at the moment, have got the control of the process of recommendation in the university. Now, it would be interesting technology allows recommendation to happen in all sorts of different ways. And John was saying, you looked at this, you might be interested in that. Is recommendation? It would be interesting to see how the teaching community reacted if other forms of recommendation started happening spontaneously around the university. And one's feeling would be that they might want to get involved.
Basically, we've involved them in actually putting on the first reading list, so to speak. We've updated it. We've got all the information on ERWeb, which is what the clinical students use. We've been doing all the hard work, and it's taken a lot of man hours. Every May, we've been spending hours and hours putting it on. But now, we automatically update new editions. Mm-hmm. We also suggest anything in their areas. This has just come into the library that we've ordered. And they've really taken it on board, and out of about 30 reading lists we have, 20 of the lecturers now are regularly corresponding with us and updating.
Brilliant. Well, that's an example of
the ERWeb. If we can convert into it would have to be sold, but you know, centralised, but it's actually going to be better.
Or take on some of the aspects of the successful project that you've got up and running, and just filter them out. I mean, if you have a successful model, then that's really something pretty. But I think that's the kind of thing you could work on, because I bet a lot of those man hours were getting it wrong before you got it right.
Is the technology is actually making it incredibly easy to take information from the existing
rather than me killing it. So it's the drag and drop thing that the technology uses to some extent.
Yeah. I think that this is the point, in a sense, I was trying to make, is that it's true that lots of past projects like this have failed, and that's absolutely true. But it seems that the changing factor is the kind of technology which increases the benefit, and you would think, I don't know, it seems to me that it's reaching the point where the benefits. The pain is getting less and the pleasure is getting more. So things aren't getting easier. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, one of the things you referred to in your report, which I've just mentioned tonight, is that one resistance you get from academics is that the idea that you're making things too easy for students are doing this and you're spoon-feeding them and all that. And actually, I've had also experience with someone that I've talked to about reading this just recently, and they basically want to hide it. I mean, they don't want it online, they don't want
I think that's true, and it's a valid concern. But the counter argument that is that dealing with these kind of aggregated data, you know, systems of data which connect to other data systems, often drop you in the middle of nowhere, and you in the middle of a system, and you have to navigate your way out. That seems to me to actually be a more relevant data skill for the 21st century, because that's what I do. When was the last time that you were looking for something? You went to the front page, the home page of something, through, you know, the portal, typed in your keyword search on the advanced search. But what you tend to do now is you go into Google and you go right into the middle of something. And you're like, ah, there's a bit of information there. Where am I? And then you start looking around. Ah, there's a button called home. I wonder if I would. And that essentially, those kind of data skills, it seems to me, jumping through data sets, linking up data sets, that's what's happening, particularly in the sciences. People are doing it.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that point about some academics not wanting their reading list to be known. I mean, I think that there's a certain amount of anthropology to be done here, because reading lists have meanings for academics as well. One of the strange findings of the MIT open coursework thing, MIT decided they would put all of their stuff, all of the teaching stuff, on the web for free, but it's made, one of its main benefits was that it enabled academics across the world to see what readings MIT academics were recommending at any moment, and what that also meant is that was an uncomfortable experience for many academics across the world, because it suggested that they were themselves slightly out of date. So there is a sense, I mean, some people might be very embarrassed about having their readings public, because actually they're not up to it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that's a different type of, but we need to understand more of that.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think
Emma and
Ed.
I'd just like to go back to the point on fulfillment and picking on Patricia's comment and the other one as well, in that, as you said, fulfillment in the digital age can be incredibly easy, but it also can be incredibly difficult, and I'm the first to admit that our e-resources, especially, are not easy to navigate. The key selling point of Mendeley is that where possible it grabs the data in and holds it on your desktop. More we can do to not only link through to a resource, but potentially pull the resource into the user's space.
Sure.
Same way perhaps you've been doing with the widget. These technological problems that were a big problem 3 or 4 years ago are not.
Yeah.
So much
less so and less so. Right.
Licenses, of course, permit them.
Yeah.
Emma, did you want to?
Yeah, my friend actually follows on from Marilyn's and from John's, which is that reading this might mean different things as conduits to different stakeholders. Do you want to use a reading list as just the easiest way to get from the suggested material into the material? Or is there going to be a dimension where we want to put in a kind of extra facet where there is a teachable moment in there?
A lot of people want to
incorporate that teachable moment, whether it's good citation practice or whether it is a kind of librarianly, this is how you search Newton, this is where you need to go, and there is this kind of paternalistic element almost. And I think probably different stakeholders will have different unvoiced assumptions about what a reading list actually does.
Sure.
Is that something that you've had a chance to explore?
Well, yes, I did look at a lot of reading lists. It was literally hundreds, and it was interesting. What came across is that people were doing different things with reading lists. Some of them were doing straight resource lists, just assume that if it's on the list, then read it. Others had citations, our citations, they refer to works, embedded in large amounts of teaching material. And others had kind of phrases like read Jones on history or don't read. And all those negative citations. On no account read. So how do you fit that into a reading list system? This is not recommended for you. I think you're right. The people use them in an enormous variety of ways. And in a sense, that's what I was trying to... In the doing new stuff bit, one of the things that I didn't really have time to explore was the idea that essentially you could build a system which does the standard things standardly, but by separating them out allows the end product to retain the kind of flexibility that it originally had. And it's quite difficult to explain. But if you say, right, okay, citations, that they just have to be standard so they can link. But you can put a citation anywhere, and you can use it for anything. So you can have a citation in a large block of text, and it would link to a resource, or you could have a list of citations that would link to a resource. So I was thinking about some of the new ways in which people might use it. And I was things like having a citation to an article followed by the citation to the data set upon which the conclusions of the article are based, and asking a student a question: do you look at the data set, do you still agree with the conclusions of the article? So there's not only the existing diversity, you want to promote whole new ways of using this kind of recommendation. And I think that as time went by, that would also be an aim. You know, this idea which John talks about a lot, looking at function rather than form. You know, at the present, reading lists of citations are the way which recommendations handled. Is that going to be true? It might be true in 10 years' time.
You were very lucky to have sort of college faculty and department librarians in the room. What's you are the interface between the academics and the students in all of this. What's your feedback on? Yeah,
I think there's a tremendous variety of reactions to the whole issue of reading lists within a department and from one department to another. I mean, in my department, if I start communicating about reading lists, there are some academics are quite involved, and some just don't answer at all.
Mm.
And our reading lists are all embedded in course documents. They're not, with very, very few exceptions, they're not separate documents, which means that the student can't really ignore them. They're produced by the academic as part of the whole work they're doing. They can't ignore them either. But from the point of view of a college librarian, they must be very, very frustratingly scattered and so forth. And then someone from another department came to us and they said, well, we just go on the web to this, here we are, teaching course document. She said, oh, that's marvellous. Well, that's so accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what do? And she said, well, you have to find the academic teaching the course physically, where they are. Bother them. Keep bothering them until they give you a piece of paper. I think this idea of some point that makes it all worthwhile is probably the way to go, because if you try and devise a system that fits to the whole spectrum of how people react to reading this now, you probably despair, because it's just so diverse.
Yeah.
But if you've got one sort of juicy selling point,
so that's going back to what's in it for me, from the different constituents,
yeah.
And you have
to
address all these different constituents to draw everybody in.
I think one of the important factors might be the keeping it up to dateness, how to keep your reading list, because you probably in great depth what the benefit of that book is. You know, just no one can
and that's going back to what Anne said and saying, you know, and what the Amazon thing as well. So, Anna.
So, we're just in looking at this whole thing horse about face, aren't we? The academics fully consider the annual call from the librarian to give them a new reading list with as much dread as the librarian sends it out to me. Oh, I'm about to delve into something to give my work. Mm-hmm. So, why are we setting up systems to support the academics being continually updated as to the new material, regular searches of the BMP or whatever it's called to get them the new books on their subject, and just having that automatically sending through regular searches of the journals to say, well, these are the latest articles on this particular topic. Why isn't that set up so that they can then cherry pick in a better way to make it less onerous for them to update it? Because we have some crazies who continually recommend out of print books.
Any academics here in the audience? Anybody more to be offended? To make your life easier.
I think this idea that it's a focus for communication, when that communication can happen in both directions and every direction, and it's a good thing. You know, somehow making it an issue, having some kind of system, having some kind of system to that communication will clarify lots of things which are just, which, you know, it seems to me a slightly out of control in some areas.
Read this book also read, but people who read this book actually thought it wasn't worth it, people had written on, thanks for the reading list for nothing, and actually found the X book much more helpful. So it's previous year's recommendations which would support the next year coming through, and then the academics see the reading list and think, these little rascals have only read about two books out of the ones that I actually recommend, and I've gone off piece and are starting to read other things because that's more useful to them. I think that would be as big a wake up call to say, well, what is the point of recommending things that aren't actually being read? Yes, there's an end goal, and are they going to be examined on them? Is practically the only thing in their head. But you can get information about hematology from a variety of different sources. You don't just have to look at what they recommend.
Mm. Okay. Anything else, Tony?
Yeah, just to pick up on that point, to what extent do you get the reading system and you get integration with the MASD identification for the courses that the students are on? To what extent would you be able to provide information back to academics about the resources that were actually being used by students? On
yeah, campus? Which ones though? To compare your reading list to this list of what your students are borrowing. I think that would be an would you? I think I'd be interested
students
in that if I was running
a
course. But it would be anonymised, you know, kind of not Jeremy is reading. But you know, last year, compare this list of books on your reading list to this list of books which were taken out by people on your course. And this is what I was talking about. That, you know, this isn't very far away. The minute we get the link through to the students' courses, we'll be able to provide information based on course borrowing. And that's going to be, I think that's going to be really interesting. But I hope that they're going to be really, I hope that's going to be an interesting one.
Okay, well, I think that's been really, really interesting discussions. This is a topic that's clearly close to, you know, a lot of people's hearts in this room, certainly. And I would say that, you know, probably be in touch with some of you if we are looking for champions or anything to take this further, and there'll, you know, be more about it, hopefully. But thanks again to Hugh and to John for this evening's seminar, and thanks for coming. Sorry.
Next week's
Oh, yes, and next week's seminar is also on Tuesday evening at 6 o'clock in which room?
It's over in the Rogerina room over in the Chancellor Centre.
And you have to give the whole topic again.
It's Dunklow, Scholarly Publishing 2.0.
Okay. So hopefully see you all there as well.
One final thing. There's a talk on, I can't remember what it's, Tony's giving a talk in the Morrison Room
this Friday lunchtime,
which is
going
to be great. Yeah.
get all the ads into this.
Morrison Room, 1 o'clock.
Thanks again.
stick.
That would be funny, actually. Next door, they already have uniforms.
You find the action.
See, this business of them embedding their reading list in the course document.
Yeah.
It's a sticky one from my eye.
Yeah.
But I wonder if, you know, if you could find a standard way of. I think there are lots of things about the system.
I was just going to take the projector so to stop people chopping over.
Which I think that's still possible. I think it's still possible to integrate that kind of.
The individual items at the top of the screen turning into just a normal looking list that they could just copy and paste.
Yeah.
In, but the system somehow told them if there was a new edition.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I think that once you get that bridge, that communication, I think, you know, you can go both ways. It's not something I've really thought about, but of course, why not? I never recommend stuff to academics. You're recommending stuff all over the place. So there's not.
Yeah, I mean, I have a professor come into the library and say, well, I'm going to be teaching this course. What have you got on this course?
And
I just thought it was a good opportunity to get a plug in.
It threw up a number of interesting things.
Sue, thank you very much.
I'll write that down so I can recommend the
most exciting part of my week.
So she went away with three books.
Trust me, I do like this room.
She found the
it is actually really nice.
Yeah.
I definitely
she's also, she's well, personally.